Welcome to Trending in Education. Mike Palmer here. I'm joined today by Marshall Poe, who is the founder and editor of the New Books Network, which is a podcasting network. Definitely an interesting space that we're going to get into around audio and education and a lot of the really interesting work that he's doing over there. Before we get into any of that, Marshall, welcome to Trending in Education.
Well, I'm very glad to be here and glad to see you again.
Absolutely. I think last time we saw each other was in 2019, which I affectionately refer to as the before times. And we're still here. We're still podcasting.
Yeah.
I think we met at Sound Education.
Sound Education, yeah.
Which was a podcasting conference focused specifically on educational podcasts.
That's right.
You know, I'd love to see that perhaps come back. But in that vein, you know, maybe we could get into some of these topics in this conversation. But we always like to begin with your origin story. How did you get to this point in your professional life? I know you can spin a yarn.
Yes. And it is really quite a story. I was a Russian historian. I studied Russia and I wrote books about Russia. And I kind of got to the point in my career, I was about 40, in which I thought I had learned as much about Russian history as I wanted to know. Mm-hmm. And then kind of by accident, I got a job at the Atlantic magazine. Mm-hmm. I'd always been interested in the dissemination of serious ideas to the public.
Yeah.
It's an important part of democracy. We need an informed public. And so I worked for them for 5 years and wrote for them and did some editing. And what I learned there was, although they do great work, the medium was wrong.
Mm.
And this is essentially because people find reading difficult. I am dyslexic and I didn't read until I was like 8.
Mm.
I still find reading a little bit difficult. So also sort of by accident, I went back to academia in 2007 and was a professor again. And I started to conduct various experiments in dissemination of what I think is like serious ideas to the public,
mm-hmm.
in addition to teaching Russian history and all the other stuff I was doing. And one of them was a podcast called New Books in History.
Mm.
And the purpose of that was simply to see if people would listen to professors talk about their new books.
Yep.
All professors will complain after they publish a book that they don't get any love.
Right.
And it is quite true that they don't.
Mm.
The university presses are all understaffed, so they don't really have the resources to go out and get these people into the public so that their ideas can kind of flow into civil society.
Right.
And I looked at podcasting and I said, you know, maybe this is a way to do it because people do like to listen.
Right.
I know I did. I'm a big fan and always have been of audiobooks. I listen to a lot of audiobooks.
Yeah. Me too. So, and just putting this in time, this is like 2007 or so?
2007, yeah.
Okay.
This is just very early days of podcasting. And so I taught myself all the skills needed to do it. And this is before we had all the technology that we have now. So my podcast was self-hosted. And,
yeah.
you know, actually, initially, I used to use Skype out to call people on their cell phones.
Right.
And, you know, it was very primitive back then.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, a lot of people did listen. Thousands of people listened to these historians talking about their books. Mm-hmm. And I found that very encouraging. And the historians were very willing to be on the show. And the presses were very willing to send me the books.
Yep.
So I thought, this is really cool. And so I continued to do that for about 3 years. And at that point, the New Books in History had grown to the point that it was clear that this model would work in other disciplines.
Yeah.
And so I contacted a few academics that I knew, and I said, would you like to send out new books in philosophy,
mm-hmm.
or new books in African-American studies? And most said no, but some said yes. And I kind of made a deal with them. I said, if you pick the books and do the interviews, I'll do everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And this is essentially how I became a publisher, which is really what I am now.
Yeah.
And it was at that point that the network really started to grow because word spread around academia about what we were doing. And then just out of the blue, people started to contact me, other academics, and they'd say, why isn't there new books in anthropology? Why isn't there new books in sociology?
Right.
And I said the same thing. I said, if you pick the books and do the interviews, record the interviews, I'll do everything else. That means audio editing, publication,
yep.
and promotion. Because those are technical skills and I knew how to do them and they didn't.
Right.
And really that's how the network grew from roughly 2011 to the present, is through people contacting me and saying, you know, can we spin up a channel? Another thing also happened, and that was that people with academic podcasts or scholarly podcasts approached me and said, you know, we see that you're really big. Could you host our podcast?
I see.
And I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. And then I distribute their podcasts on we call the organic NDN channels. They have their own RSS feed, their own podcast. But, you know, if I have a podcast that's produced by, you know, let's say an Anthropologist, whatever it's called, it's on the NBN, but those episodes will be cross-posted to New Books in Anthropology because obviously they're, you know, about anthropology.
Yeah.
And the audience seemed to like this. So it was in that way, as I say, that the network grew to its current size, and we have over 150 podcasts now and over 1,000 hosts. I think we host about 50 podcasts. And then we also got a certain amount of buy-in from the university presses. And this actually started, I think the Princeton people deserve credit for this. It was 5 years ago. They contacted me and they said something like, and this is a pretty typical story, we tried to do a podcast in-house, but we can't.
Yep.
But we see that you can do it. Would you do it for us?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I would, because we do a lot of your books.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you are a Russian historian, you know, so you got some bona fides within the academic scholarly network.
I understand, you know, what academics want and the way they think. And and I've published with university presses. I have a good relation. I actually published a book at Princeton a long time ago. So at that point, we started to host podcasts from university presses. And I think now we have 15 or something, and we're getting new ones all the time because we're really kind of an important part of their ecosystem in the sense that, you know, we promote their books, and that's what we want to do. We want to help them sell books, and we want to help promote their authors.
When you said ecosystem, I thought ECH of system, and you meant ecosystem, but they both kind of work. You're spreading the word, right?
Yeah, we're spreading the word because that, and I should have said this at the onset, that the purpose of it from the beginning was public education. Mm-hmm. Full stop.
Yeah.
There's really nothing more to say. That was it. It was just to get the ideas and knowledge and wisdom that is kind of trapped in these books out into the public. So it's available to people all over the world. You know, most people don't know about these books. If they do know about them, they're expensive often.
Right.
And then even if you buy the book, you've got to read it. That takes time.
Sure.
So if you can kind of get the kernel or the nugget of a book in an hour-long interview with an author, well, that's a really good thing. And then maybe go on and buy the book if you're really interested, and we hope that you do.
Right.
But yeah, that's the purpose of the entire network. It's really just a public education project that, you know, I mean, it took over my life. I never expected it to do this, but I quit my job as a professor in 2012.
Okay.
Worked on it full-time.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't both be a professor and run the network.
Yeah.
Then there were some lean years because it wasn't clear how it was going to be paid for.
Right.
And so I had various side gigs, but it was still pretty inexpensive at the time. But it did kind of come to the point where I really needed to find a way to make a living from it. And it was at that point, about 2018, that we joined forces with Megaphone, which is a big podcast hosting platform.
Yeah.
And I stopped self-hosting. I started to host on Megaphone. And so essentially the network is funded by advertising at this point. But, you know, it was kind of a big decision for me because I didn't really know what to do. But when faced between insolvency and, you know, advertisement, well, you're going to get advertisement.
Yeah. The invisible hand of the marketplace.
Yeah. And I'm surprised because nobody seems to object to the ads. I mean, it was a long time in podcasting. People didn't know what the funding model was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
People were trying all kinds of things, and we did too. We took donations, subscriptions, but it settled on advertising. It is advertising now.
Yeah.
And people don't seem to object to that.
Mm-hmm.
They understand things have to be paid for.
Yeah. And it's a credit to you that you've reached a scale that you can monetize on advertising, because I think that's one of the other elements of starting a podcast is building the audience.
Yeah.
And then also your audience, I imagine, can kind of cross-pollinate. If somebody listens to New Books in History, they're pretty likely to listen to New Books.
Yeah, and we see this a lot. Yeah, we see people subscribing to multiple channels. Because, you know, one of the things I learned is that no book is about one thing.
Right.
All books are about several things. So we do a lot of cross-posting on the network. So, you know, a book about, you know, German women is going to be published on German Studies, and it's going to be published on New Books in Gender, and it's going to be studies on New Books in Women's History. And
Right.
Because all of these audiences are going to be interested in it.
Right.
So, the channels kind of fertilize one another.
Right.
And
right.
I think this is appropriate, and the listeners seem to like it. So that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of scale, this is a big problem in podcasting because, you know, people approach me a lot asking, you know, should I start a podcast? And I hate to tell them that, well, no, you probably shouldn't. Unless you are super dedicated to something that's really narrow, mm-hmm. and are willing to donate your time.
Right.
I mean, the number of people that actually make a living in podcasting is vanishingly small.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize this mm-hmm. because if you read the trade news, it's all about stars.
Yeah. Big deals.
Yeah. Big deals. Mm-hmm. And the kind of enormous, there are 4 million podcasts now, the enormous middle of podcasting, and Lord, you don't ever hear anything about that. And that's where we are.
Right.
We're not huge. We don't have hits. You're never going to see us in the top 100.
Right.
But we serve a community of people
mm-hmm.
that is really very interested in this material.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
We can do it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a big fan of the expression, there's riches in the niches, you know, because
well,
it
rhymes. That's what we're about. Yeah. We're all about, I call it narrow casting.
Yep.
And that's really what we do. We narrow cast. Mm-hmm. We're not interested in reaching, I mean, it'd be great to reach zillions and zillions of people, but we don't select our editorial content on the basis of how many listeners it's going to get.
Right.
We select it on the basis of how good it is.
But then I guess you're an interesting bellwether for academic publishing and for higher ed, at least in terms of opportunities to engage the audience in a way beyond a book, which is something that I've always been struck by the narrowness of the publisher's orientation. I think they would like to have a podcast, but they typically don't have the wherewithal, don't really want to, you know, apply the energy to it. But as a book reader or audiobook listener, I love it when there's bonus content yeah. and when there's more audio, more media for me to chew on.
Yeah. And this has happened over and over. I don't know about quite a number, but a number of pretty big university presses did try podcasting.
Yep.
And what they discovered is that they really didn't have capacity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they couldn't have learned, they could have, but they were too busy doing other things.
Yep.
And that's kind of where we fit in, is that we were already covering their books.
Yep.
For example, we just onboarded MIT. MIT had a podcast and they produced like 100 episodes, their fine episodes. You know, by the time they came on, we had already done 200 of their books.
Mm-hmm.
So right. suddenly you have a podcast with 300 items in it.
Right,
and that's
right.
good for MIT and MIT's authors and MIT's readers and so on and so forth. And yeah, it helps them in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. It's kind of outsourcing. I mean, they could do it yeah. internally, I suppose, but you know, we have the technical skills and the efficiencies that are necessary to do it at scale really inexpensively.
Yeah.
Which is just what you want.
Mm-hmm. And the decentralization of the model is interesting too, where I think frequently folks think of media plays and networks as a little more top down, and this is much more kind of organic and across.
Well, it is crowdsourced, but the crowd is very specific. It's professors.
Right.
To be an NBN host, anybody can apply. Mm-hmm. You really have to have some domain expertise. And essentially that means you need to be a graduate student.
Yeah.
Working toward a PhD, or you have to have a PhD, or you have to be a professor.
Right.
And so we have over 1,000 hosts and they all fit that profile. I mean,
right.
I know because I onboard them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're simply interested in talking to their colleagues about their books, which is when I was a professor, that's what I wanted to do too.
Right.
You know, that's why I started New Books in History. I just like, I wanted to talk to historians about their books.
Mm-hmm.
I like history books. I like talking to people about history books. And, you know, they feel the same way. And
yeah.
actually the time commitment for them is not great. They already know the subject really well.
Sure.
They're going to get a free book.
Right.
They may even know the person they're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they need to ask 7 questions. And the author, of course, will do all the talking. I mean, in
right.
a typical NBN interview, which is
yeah.
an hour long, the author talks for 58 minutes.
As a host, I've always appreciated the halo effect where you have smart people on with you. You know, you kind of burnish your perception by being in conversation with smart people.
Yeah.
So
and,
like,
that's true, too. You know, that's absolutely true, too. I have kind of, you know, I have interviewed people, I'll admit to this, I read a lot of novels. I've read novels that I really liked.
Yeah.
And I interviewed the author of the novel because I wanted to talk to them.
Yeah.
And I think that has a certain value. But, you know, I always tell people that you really shouldn't do this unless you like talking to people.
Yeah.
And you're comfortable with the technology. It's not difficult anymore. In fact, it's improved tremendously.
Right.
It's so much easier to do it now than it was in the early days.
Right, right.
The audio is much better. The publication is much easier. There are now these hosting companies. You know, there's all kinds of tools, including AI tools, which are very helpful.
Yeah.
And so it's just much easier to do. And I mean, there's a good side to this and a bad side. I mean, when I started, there were a couple 100,000 podcasts, maybe.
Right.
There are 4 million.
Right.
And that's a lot of competition.
Sure.
You know, now how many of those 4 million are actually active and will they have listeners? I don't know.
Right.
But still, it's a lot of competition.
Right.
And we didn't face that in the early days. Yeah. So it's become much more competitive just to get listeners. Nobody does what the Nubix Network does. That's absolutely true or unique. But there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot to choose from.
And then since you have this breadth, that's where I'd be curious. We're a trend spotting show trying to understand what's happening in the world of learning. Like, you at least are uncovering the niches that are hot or the spaces where you're seeing the most interest, even the number of episodes and the number of books, I guess, that you're covering. Those types of trends probably are interesting bellwethers for what's new, what's on the rise, what's maybe on the decline. You seeing anything interesting out there?
Well, not in the sense that you mean, I think. The trend that I have seen over the past 10 years is an increasing embrace of podcasting, both as a host and a listener, among academics. Mm-hmm. When I started, it was very hard to get people to host.
Yeah.
They didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. They'd never listened to a podcast.
Yeah.
And they weren't comfortable with the technology. They didn't want to appear in front of the microphone. And
right.
So, you know, we did a kind of what they call in business a cold start. You know, I had nothing to show anyone. I just had to go beg them to do this. Now, what has happened is, well, let me put it this way. We used to do recruiting drives.
Yeah.
For hosts. We don't do them anymore because
right.
people just come over the transom to do it.
Yeah.
And that's great. I mean,
right.
they know about the Nubix Network. They know there's this opportunity. Mm-hmm. They know they might benefit from the opportunity and it might be kind of fun.
Right.
And so, yeah, the hosts from this crowd of professors just come to us now.
Right.
And that I think signals an adoption of this sort of both expression and use of the medium itself in the classroom. Because I think
right.
these are used in the classroom all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I know they are.
Yeah. It's interesting too. I talked to my wife who is also a doctor of philosophy. So I understand that element of her background. And, you know, as a podcaster, I frequently am wondering how an academic can reconcile with their CV a podcast appearance.
No, this is another. Yeah, actually, this is another thing that's interesting, and is I guess it's surprising. I'm asked to write letters of recommendation pretty frequently from mm-hmm. people who've been hosts on the podcast because they want to demonstrate that they're interested in public outreach.
Yeah,
and this is far and away the best way to do it. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no better way to do it. You know, a typical monograph is going to be printed in 400 copies, and almost all of them are going to be sold to libraries, and that's it.
Right.
But if that monograph author appears on the NBN, thousands of people are going to listen to them talk about it.
Right.
And the person who facilitates that is the host, gets credit to that.
Right.
And so it now counts, you know, like people can show that they are actually interested in public outreach because they've been hosts on the NBN.
Right.
And, you know, we provide numbers like, you reach 500,000 people or something like this. And that looks good.
Yeah.
And it should look good. It should count because
right.
this is kind of an age-old problem in academia. I call it the gap. And it's the gap between what experts know, professors, and what everybody knows. And
mm-hmm.
it's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always interested in ways to close that gap.
Yeah.
And it seems to me podcasting is a great way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And also I should add that, you know, in terms of using NBN interviews in the classroom and for whatever purpose, is that it is kind of fit for academia because unlike, say, Wikipedia, it's the expert talking, the
right.
person.
Mm-hmm.
It's not some random editor who's editing the Wikipedia page. It's the person who wrote the book.
Right.
And even better, if you really want to know what that expert has to say, you can read the book.
Right.
And academics are very comfortable with that. They're like, okay, we're going to introduce you to the book. I'm an expert. And you can go and read the book if you want.
Right. Right.
And this is very different. You know, people are very ambivalent about using Wikipedia in the classroom for good reason, because
sure.
like, you don't really know who's behind that stuff.
Yeah. Same thing with ChatGPT, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. Like, I actually had an interesting conversation with somebody about that the other day. And in a way, that makes what we do even more valuable.
Right.
Because it's not some random person talking. It's Marshall Poe. Like, if Marshall Poe is going to talk to you about Russian history, about his Russian history book, you can email Marshall Poe.
Sure.
And you can ask him.
Right.
You know, and I think the value of that kind of personal connection is very great in a world that's been kind of buried in anonymity.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes most academics very uncomfortable, and it makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah. I really liked your point about, as someone with dyslexia, you know, listening to content is maybe a more natural format. I think that's actually true, even if you think about what we're wired for, you know.
Well, I think it's totally true. I mean,
how long we've been listening versus how long we've been reading.
I wrote a book on the history of communication. And one of the things that I, you know, like to point out to people is we were born with watching and listening organs. We were not born with reading organs.
Right.
It actually takes quite a long time to teach someone to read. Some people never learn to do it at all.
Right.
You know, it was tough for me. Mm-hmm. Reading takes all of your attention.
Right.
All of your processing power in reading. Mm-hmm. But listening's not like that.
Right.
Listening is much more natural to us.
And then there's also a skill, I think, to the paralinguistic stuff, the way you intone your words, the way you try to
Well, this is just it. I mean, I point this out to people all the time. One of the things that we do, which kind of gets buried, is we're preserving voices.
Mm.
Just the voices of the people. And if you think about it, you know, like, how great would it be to have it an interview with Nietzsche?
Yeah.
A recorded interview with Nietzsche or Marx or John Locke or I don't know who, you know.
Sure, yeah.
W.E.B. Du Bois. That'd be great. Well, actually, we do have recordings of him. You know, to actually hear the person.
Right.
It's an integral part of who they are, their voice. Not some, you know, it's not text on a page. It's their voice, their talking.
Right.
And I think that's a great value.
Yeah. I also think a lot about rapport building, and that's the other thing that's kind of baked into your model, but the type of conversation that people have, it can be a dialogue, there can be exchanges, but also it's typically built off of a foundation of trust and maybe mutual esteem. And it does feel like there is a little bit of a bring a friend element to how you source these interviews.
You know, there absolutely is. And I tell people, you know, you should interview your colleagues. If you want to do your colleague a favor, that's great. Do it.
Yeah.
We just want to get them on so we can spread what they said in their book out to the public.
Yeah.
And, you know, about rapport, one of the things that I always tell people about the NBN is we don't do reviews. We are not telling you whether this is a good book or a bad book. It's probably a good book because it was published by a UP and they're serious folks.
Right.
But we're not saying, we're not evaluating the book. What we're doing is we're asking the author to tell you what they found in their research and wrote in their book.
Right.
Full stop. We're not in the business of reviewing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the purpose of the interviews is really to get the author talking about what they found. And usually this is ignored because the people we interview talk for a living.
Sure.
As teachers. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
The thing that I'm struck by frequently is that the conversation can lose the audience at times, and especially when you're talking about an academic audience, you know, or an academic interview. There's a risk that it's kind of over people's heads. And I think that may relate a little bit to, you know, how deep in the niche you want to go and how do you connect crossover? But how do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, obviously this is a difficulty, but, you know, there's a reason that books are written and not spoken.
Mm.
And that is because writing is very good for technical subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the extreme example of that is we don't do math orally.
Yeah.
Math has to be written down. You cannot do it without writing it down.
You could probably pantomime math, but that would take a lot of work.
It would be tough, though, because you need that symbol set to do it. It needs to have permanence, and, you know, you need to be able to move the symbols around, juxtapose them, and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's for good reason that text is privileged in academia. It should be. Absolutely should be. But when you get somebody talking, they're going to boil it down for you. And they're going to put it in colloquial terms.
Mm-hmm.
And they're extemporizing, you're not reading. Because as you know, I mean, the way I write and the way I talk are really very different.
That's true.
And so I'm going to boil it down for you.
Right.
You know, I might get some things, you know, we might lose some nuance and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think that is kind of a trade-off that's worth it because, you know, you get to hear what the author has to say in the author's own words.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a great value.
Yeah. And your point about, you know, really capturing voices for posterity and, you know, sort of the emotional resonance of the human voice, like how it is, like, it's another kind of fingerprint that we all have.
Fingerprint is a great, that's great. I'm going to steal that.
But then, you know, what happens now? You mentioned AI, you know, like a lot of the technologies emerging, deep fakes are emerging. I think it was the Grammys during the in memoriam phase of the Grammys. I'm pretty sure Tony Bennett was doing a duet and he's no longer with us, you know? So there's an element where you can kind of lose touch with reality. Where do you see some of this technology heading?
Well, like I say, I think that makes what we do even more valuable because we are all about the person. I mean, if you look at a New Books Network interview on the New Books Network website or on the podcast, the author's name is the first thing you see.
Yeah.
Like an actual person in the meat space, as people used to. Yeah. It's not It's the actual person.
Yeah.
There's no faking going on at all. So again, in a world where lots of stuff can be faked, we're more valuable, I think,
right?
Because we're preserving the actual voice. Now, I do think that in terms of podcasting, some AI tools are useful. I can just mention one that Adobe cooked up. They created something that makes almost any decent audio sound like it was recorded in a studio.
Yep.
I would highly recommend this to anybody. It's Vocal Enhancer. We don't use it all the time, but sometimes we do use it on audio that's
poor. Yeah. Raises the floor, you know,
yeah,
like
it just, yeah. And, you know, the audio quality was always tough for us because we're dealing with people who are essentially audio amateurs. They're professors in their offices. They don't know.
Yeah.
And why should they? So this AI tool has been very, very useful for us because we can really clean up the audio and make it sound better for people. You know, more generally about AI, you know, I don't know what impact it's going to have on us. It's just too early to tell.
Yeah. The area that's interesting that you're kind of bringing to my attention here too is something that moves so fast, like artificial intelligence. It's really disruptive. Higher ed traditionally is kind of slow to respond. Academics are slow to respond. But if they have channels like podcasts available to them, you can get more access to them sooner, I guess, and sort of like a less formal, less peer reviewed at the same time, but more extemporaneous, more spontaneous. I imagine there's some element of responsivity to these types of formats that open up a real opportunity for public engagement with ideas.
Well, I say about the NBN, it's an entry point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not where you should stop. So if you're interested in British, you know, British studies, you can go subscribe to New Books in British Studies and you'll see some new books and you'll hear the authors talking about them.
Yeah.
And maybe you're interested in Britain, so that's good. They are authorized speakers, that is, they have PhDs or professors.
Yeah.
And you can go further because you've entered already and now you can go read the book if you want.
Right.
So it is a kind of, it's an easy way to get into the material.
Right.
That I don't think we've ever had before.
Yeah. And there's value. I think many of our listeners would agree to this. There's value sometimes in just listening to the podcast and never reading the book.
I mean, many people do this. I know I hear from listeners all the time. I mean, we have fanatical listeners who, you know, they almost enjoy the kind of, somebody the other day described it as walking into a bookstore and browsing.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know what, we have almost 23,000 interviews.
Wow. Yeah.
And you know, you don't know what you're going to find in there.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's astounding. And, you know, we publish 70 new interviews a week. So you're always going to find something new. And if you're just a curious person and want to hear an academic talk about something that you didn't know about for an hour, well, there we are.
Right.
And, you know, similarly, I think that, you know, one of the things that I would really like to see happen is to see high school and college teachers use the interviews to introduce students to the world of monographs.
Mm.
Because I don't think people know it exists.
Yeah.
You know, there are a zillion monographs on every imaginable topic.
Right.
And this is a step past the textbook.
Right.
This is aligned in the textbook.
Mm-hmm.
But here's somebody talking for an hour who spent 10 years studying this line in the textbook.
Right.
So, you know, it adds an entirely new level of depth.
Mm.
You can learn more if you want.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I would really like to see. You know, I did that when I was teaching and I think the students appreciate it. There's another place you can go, a deeper place if you want to get further into the weeds. And it's audio, so you can do it while you're working out.
Right.
Right. And then maybe you can take the next step and read the book, go to the library, get it, you know?
Right. So any thoughts there, like as you maybe look ahead at emerging media, you know, the VR, AR revolutions that are happening and artificial intelligence, all the emerging technology, at the end of the day, the spoken word kind of undergirds a lot of this stuff. So I'd love to get a little bit of your musing, perhaps, especially for our listeners, folks who are in learning, folks who are in education, thoughts about how to think about audio, think about voice, think about storytelling as it relates to all this?
Well, in terms of like podcasting in general, what I tell people is this. If you want a podcast, you should pick something very narrow. And you should think about the target audience. And that audience should be narrow. Because one of the wonderful things about podcasting that is not appreciated is that it does precisely allow narrow casting.
Yeah.
The traditional media cannot do it. CNN and NBC and so on, they can't do it. You know, an example I sometimes give is there are several really good podcasts on plumbing And they're actually really good. I do home improvement and I've renovated houses. And so like the community of plumbers now has a voice.
Right.
And that's a good thing, right? Yeah. That's good. Mm-hmm. Traditional media could not supply that.
Yeah.
And these are actual people, plumbers and people in plumbing supply and so on and so forth, talking about what they know and exchanging information. And, you know, it's out of these little communities of interest that civil society is born.
Right.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And so facilitating communication within those communities, and that's what we do on the NIBIX network, you know, anthropologists talking to historians, that's a good thing. It's a very good thing. And the natural way to do it is to talk, not to write, not to do sign language, not to use smoke signals.
Yeah.
Talk. And we can do that now because the economics are such that you can do it pretty inexpensively.
Yeah. And I'll forego bringing Nancy, our virtual co-host, into the conversation, okay, which would make it even more confusing. How about just higher ed in general? And you know, as from where you sit, there's the formal construct of higher education, and it's an institution that's facing some existential challenges in a bunch of different ways. And then at the same time, there's this informal media channel you've spent a lot of time with in podcasting, which in some ways is resilient and broad and maybe thriving in new ways. Any thoughts on the juxtaposition of those two things?
Well, I mean, this may sound grandiose, but I think of the NIBIX Network as an academic institution, like a university press, but not a university press. There are lots of university presses.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one NIBIX Network, and we serve all the university presses.
Mm-hmm.
But we're really all about getting what people in higher education generally, not just higher education, know out into the public.
Yeah,
that is our sole mission. So, you know, I'm very supportive of colleges and universities, and I hope they'll be supportive of us.
Right.
Because, you know, I think we're, you know, plowing the same furrow. And I really do think about it like that. Here's an analogy. You know, the printing press came into widespread use around 1500 in Europe. And at that point, all kinds of new institutions were created, including presses, and bookstores, and everything else that was involved in that, you know, paper makers and binders and the whole news. We're kind of in a similar moment now, but with audio. You know, podcasting's not that old. Mm. And the institutions that will be around for a really long time are being created right now. You know, Oxford University Press is 500 years old.
Yeah.
And they were created around about that time. And they were created to deal with this new technology and to use it to the public good. They did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to do. We have this new technology. How can we use it to the public good?
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is teach people.
Hmm.
That's it. It's really very simple. We want to use this technology to teach people. Now, there are lots of other ways to use it, but that's the way we do it. And that's what we want to do. Those are our values.
Yeah. I love it. It reminds me, I was talking to Brandon Bastide a little while back on an episode, and he was talking about the need for education cathedral builders, people who are thinking long-term and trying to build over that sort of span of time.
Well, and I really do. You know, if I have my, I won't live to see it, but if I have my druthers, then NBN will be around for a very long time. And in 500 years, people can listen to these interviews and hear the actual voices of these people.
Right.
And I think that would be a great contribution to our culture.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of hurdles.
For sure.
Yes, there are a lot of hurdles to doing it. And there's a certain amount of resistance as well.
Right.
But we've enjoyed good success with at least professors and presses. They like what we do. And the public likes what we do as well. They listen. So if we can figure the economics of it out, then I think, you know, we will have created a cathedral.
Exactly. Well, and then, you know, the question I think is, how do you make it as inclusive as possible? And that might be the challenge too. Like, how do you translate, because the niches you're talking about are not necessarily, you know, the public square, you know, it's more folks who already are deeply connected to the cutting edge of higher education.
Yeah.
How do you think about bridging beyond there?
Well, you know, that's difficult for us because we deal with people that are already pretty far up the learning curve.
Yeah.
If you look at the NBN audience, an astounding number of them have PhDs and MDs and JDs.
Yeah.
These are already very well-educated people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything wrong with that because the content we produce is really for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to do a certain amount of work before you can understand, you know, the kinds of things that are talked about in our podcast. And that's fine. That's what the school system is for. That's how I did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's, you know, what you want to do is have good fit.
Hmm.
And I think we do have a good fit. We get people at a certain point in their life, usually after they have bachelor's degrees or something like those. And then they have kind of context that they need to listen to and understand the interviews.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the places where I do think artificial intelligence and personalization of language, it's already happening in terms of, you know, translation into and out of Russian is getting better and more natural. Yeah. There probably will be a time where experts talking about something can be translated down to the level that, you know, any listener or up, you know, for the more advanced audiences.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that. But yeah, I mean, I suppose that, yeah, I guess it would be possible.
I'm always looking for praxis, Marshall. I'm trying to figure out how do we actually put some of the more theoretical, narrower conversations, how do they then come back to like the broader fabric of society? And it may be just a hard question, but it's one that I think we have to keep asking.
Yeah, well, I mean, and we try to do that. I mean, we dumb nothing down. If you listen to any NBN interview, it's going to be on a topic that's pretty esoteric, usually. And you're going to have us in the context to understand it.
The esotericism is almost a point of pride, it sounds like.
Well, it is, yes. Yeah. It absolutely is. I mean, and that's the thing. Another thing I'm particularly proud of is that we cover things that nobody covers.
Hmm.
Not a chance.
You know,
we have a channel in biblical studies. These are people that know Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek and Latin. And they spend years and years learning these things, and they go back and they, you know, write interesting things about the Gospels. I mean, these people are incredibly well trained.
Yeah. It is kind of amazing to think that the cutting edge exists in every discipline.
There it does. Well, that's exactly a good way of putting it. It absolutely does. Yes, it absolutely does. There's a cutting edge in every one of these disciplines.
Yeah.
And, you know, we try to bring that to people because new stuff is found out all the time.
Yeah.
And where does it appear? It appears in books.
Yeah.
And so we're bringing you news from the cutting edge of these disciplines.
Yeah.
Because people are always hard at work. I mean, I know even, you know, as a Russian historian, I can tell you that, like, what I thought, you know, 20 years ago, I might not think now because new things have been discovered.
Right.
And those things are in books. Mm-hmm. And you might not have time to read that book, but you can listen to an interview. You know, I know a guy who has spent much of his life trying to find out how many wives Ivan the Terrible had. This is actually a pretty serious problem. It has lots of implications.
Yeah.
But he knows. And I think he's got the right answer now, which we didn't have before. And you know, you may think, well, that's just ridiculously obscure. But, you know, for him, it's not.
Yeah.
And for Russian historians, it's not.
I guess his ex-wives would say he was aptly named.
I think that's right. Yes. Yeah.
I'm talking with Marshall Poe. He's the founder and editor of the New Books Network. We'll include links to the New Books Network on the show page for the episode. We're about to wrap up here, Marshall. It's been amazing getting some time with you. Any concluding thoughts, any takeaways for our listeners as they head back to the rest of their lives?
I would just, you know, I would just encourage people to look at the New Books Network because you're going to find something there you're interested in. What I kind of hope is that eventually we'll become Wikipedia-like.
Mm.
That is, if you come there with a topic you're interested in and go to the search bar and you search, you're probably going to find somebody pretty smart talking about it, and there's going to be a book behind it so you can trust it.
Interesting.
That's really kind of where, you know, that's what I would like to see happen, to build that, you know, and that's the cathedral.
Yeah, it's a part cathedral, part auditory bookstore.
Yeah, well, yeah, we kind of think of it as a library, but somebody told me the other day that libraries are sort of out of fashion. Nobody told me, man. I
what?
Love libraries.
Yeah, that's a whole nother.
I love libraries.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really, I guess my concluding thought would be, you know, that we really try hard to connect experts with just ordinary people. And I think we do a pretty good job of it. You can listen to them talk about their books and maybe you can buy their books. You learn something.
Fantastic stuff. Marshall, thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
Absolutely, Michael. Thanks for having me.
And for our listeners, hopefully you enjoyed what you heard. If you did, please subscribe, tell your friends, do all the good things. This is Trending in Education.